Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Dan Nadel, writer, editor, curator, and we're talking about a new collection of comics that he's just edited with Frank Santoro called Return to Romance, The Strange Love Stories of Ogden Whitney. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Mark.
This is such an odd collection, but before we even get to that, because I actually collected these in the 60s, I want to talk about romance comics because they seem so odd. When did romance comics first come into being?
Romance comics started appearing in the late 1940s. They were kind of like an alternative for GIs and their families, you know, returning GIs and their families.
Wow.
And were meant to be a kind of clean-cut alternative to crime comics and horror comics that were really proliferating all over the place at the time. So they kind of went with this new vision of America, the prosperity of the post-war era, and, you know, offering a model in a way for what you were supposed to be in this new society.
Now, I read in the introduction to your book that Jack Kirby is credited with inventing the genre.
Jack Kirby and Joe Simon, yeah, absolutely.
Jack Kirby of Fantastic Four and Mr. Miracle and all that?
The very same one. I know. It's a strange twist, but, you know, Simon and Kirby invented so many genres of comics, and this was just one of them they hit upon when they both got back from World War II in 45. So they came up with this format, and theirs are a little stiff. They're not the most interesting, but they're good. And it caught on like so many other things they did.
Was the genre successful?
It was hugely successful. Really, for about a dozen years or so, really quite a kind of explosive sales situation. And at a certain point, it kind of wound down in the late 1950s, as a lot of comics did. And kind of people, you know, that generation grew up and out of it. And it struggled through the 60s, and then really kind of that was that.
I started seriously collecting comics in the 60s, and I remember one of the things I just thought was really odd were especially the DC romance comics, and I collected a lot of the titles, and looking back on them today, they're really strange, and I'm not sure like what they were doing or who the audience was.
I think that they thought that the audience was still teenage girls, but by the time the 60s rolled around, the people that were making the comics were well into their 40s. So I think it was sort of this strange thing that happens when one generation is providing entertainment for another. And so
it doesn't work.
Yeah, they start trying to use sort of hip lingo.
That's exactly right. There's stories with like hippies in it, and you know,
yeah.
it's just, they also had one from one time they had a guy who was answering letters who was like an anti-feminist, like obviously a cartoon anti-feminist, and they were supposed to spark debate, and it was the same basic format. As a matter of fact, Ogden Whitney had the beatniks, and yep. they had the hippies. So it was like the same, you know, dangerous guy attracting the girl, but she's really not that bad after all, and all that stuff.
Exactly. There's always that. There's always the guy or the girl you're not supposed to talk to, and yeah, always that lurking danger. Yeah.
And there's always the big smooch scene too, and the little hearts and sort of going off into the sunset.
Of course, yeah, the happy ending after all that.
Now, Ogden Whitney.
Yeah.
What a strange person! Not the least of which is that we practically know nothing about him. He's like a cipher.
He really is, and he drew himself that way. He kind of built his comics that way. I wish we knew more, but it really does seem like the trail is cold. I mean, you know, no children, one sibling who died long before Whitney did, and that's kind of it. No interviews in his lifetime that I've ever been able to find. So he really is quite a mystery.
Well, Dan, you've done a lot on the history of sort of odd comics. Is that a common story for a lot of artists and comic writers who just didn't make it big?
Well, this is particularly strange because there was no family. So often, you know, somebody might not make it big, but leave behind kids and, you know, and nieces, nephews, whatever. But this is a real gap because there's just the trail is cold. So,
let's talk about what we do know. Was he a writer or inker or penciler?
All of the above. He wrote, penciled, inked his stories. He likely, you know, did stories that other people wrote as well, but he was often doing things entirely himself.
Wow. Now, he was born here in Stoneham, Massachusetts. Uh-huh. He began work on Detective Comics, that's a huge thing. What were the titles that he worked on in Detective Comics?
He did, like, the Golden Age Sandman, which is a character that wore a gas mask.
Mm-hmm.
Put people to sleep. and then he did a character called Skyman. Lots of sort of generic superhero stuff in the early 1940s. And by then, I mean, he had already drawn a lot for pulp magazines in the 30s. So he was sort of like a middling illustrator, basically. Then he went off to war.
How would you personally rate his work on things like Skyman and Sandman? Were they interesting, at least?
Skyman is interesting. Yeah, it has a sort of verve to it. It doesn't have the kind of stiffness that his later work does. So it's both better in some ways, but also less interesting.
Now, how would you describe his style? You have a great description of his style in this collection here.
Go ahead.
It's pretty minimalist.
Yes, absolutely. I kind of call it the frozen moment school of cartooning, and also like a kind of clip art approach to cartooning. I mean, they're both similar in the sense that it's very stripped down. There's nothing in there that isn't necessary to convey the narrative. And oftentimes the people in the panels are just sort of like, almost like paper dolls cut out and placed.
That's really a good description. That's a great description. Now, the only other things before we start to talk about the comics, I want to talk about his personal life. He did struggle with alcoholism. Do we know that for a fact, or is that just a rumor?
We do know that for a fact. It came from other cartoonists who knew him. So that is a fact. It was reported by a few different people who worked at the ACG offices. That was his publishing company. So, yeah, it was known that he struggled with alcoholism. And likely, you know, this is sort of hearsay, but likely that in the end he sort of lost his sanity.
Now, he did get married.
He did get married late in life to a woman also middle-aged, and apparently had a kind of a strong marriage. She died maybe 15 years after they got married, and that was kind of the end for him, unfortunately.
Wow. Now, he did work what I consider like an important comic, Herbie.
Yeah.
Herbie, for people who have never heard of it, how would you describe Herbie?
Herbie the Fat Fury. Herbie was a rotund kid who wore sort of Coke bottle glasses and sucked on a lollipop, and his power came when he bopped people on the head with his lollipop, and Herbie would take these adventures through time and space.
It's a really odd comic, but a really good one.
Yes. Oh, it's super fun. I mean, it's really funny, it's absurd, it's kind of psychedelic.
The Beatles are in. The Beatles are in it at one point.
Beatles are in it. JFK is in
Castro.
It.
Castro's in it. Dracula. Robin Hood.
It's a great. It's one of those great kind of pop moments of the 1960s.
And was that a success?
Herbie was a sort of middling success. Yeah, not a big one, but it was certainly more successful than other titles. Yeah.
Now, you worked at ACG, and talk to me about that. You describe it as an artist-friendly house. Elaborate on that.
Artist-friendly house in the sense that it was not run top down. The guy who was the editor-in-chief, Richard Hughes, was also a writer.
Yeah.
He wrote a number of the romance stories in the book, and he wrote Herbie. So this is a place that really encouraged artists and writers just to come in and do their thing. They didn't have time to micromanage.
Huh. And when did that? When was like the peak of ACG Comics?
Oh, gee.
Like the early 60s?
Yeah, maybe the early 60s.
Now, Ann died, and then Ogden apparently went off the deep end. And what are the last known comics? Are the romance comics the last, or is it Herbie?
The last known comics are actually comics he inked for Marvel, and Wally Wood had a little imprint called Tower Comics.
Oh, yeah.
So it's sort of miscellaneous inking jobs, and then he just kind of fades out. Yeah,
you compare him at one point to Ernie Bushmiller, and when I first read that, I was like, "What?" And then I totally get it. I totally get it. But you have to explain that.
Well, Ernie Bushmiller, of course, was a creator of Nancy, and also worked in a really pared down, kind of blank style. And this has much the same kind of quality to it, which is that it's just as well, there's nothing there that doesn't have to be, really. And everything is sort of, there's no emotional tenor to it except for the actual situations that are happening.
I love when we talk about his romance comics when you write about it. He said there are several constants. One is that women with short hair are quite mad.
Yes. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I think that's sort of like, I think he just worked out a series of tropes to illustrate whatever the story was. So, yeah.
Or was he working out certain problems of himself?
Well, probably both. And certainly, so, if so, subconsciously.
What are the other constants? And this is an odd list to give people just a taste of how strange these comics are. Subtly strange, by the way. Bald men are wise.
Yes. Yes.
And men in their underwear are vulnerable.
Vulnerable, yes, of course.
Sort of seems like a given to me. It's like if I'm in my underwear, I'm definitely more vulnerable than if I'm not.
This is true. But I think, I mean, that those comics have such a high proportion of stories with men in their underwear feeling vulnerable. I mean, there's just a lot of that. Yeah, you have the sense that there were some particular fixations, and he was cycling through them.
And you also talk about how he portrays things like anger and confusion and sort of powerful emotions. How does he do that?
Anger. Well, you know what he would do is just isolate a single face in a panel, and just sort of have really a close up on an expression, and then there'd just be flat color behind it. It's very kind of pop artist, really, but it's and most likely he would have been aware of it in magazines and things like that. Just a very pared down compositional technique.
Well, you bring up the question about how self-aware he was. I mean, are we attributing too much to his artistic sensibilities, or is he just doing this because it's the shortest way to get it done?
I think it's a little bit of both.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think there can be any real accident that somebody just stumbles into something this striking and this unusual. On the other hand, he was on very tight deadlines, and there's no evidence that he was that he had some other secret, profound project that he was working on. So I think it's probably a mix. I think he was an inspired craftsman.
Now, Liana Fink writes a great introduction to this collection, too. I really liked it, and I liked what she said about it. The comics are obviously sexist, but they're sort of so above board, in your face, crazy, out of time, sexist. She describes it as propaganda, but at the same time, fairy tales. Can you talk about that?
Propaganda, but at the same time, I mean, I don't think, I don't think they're really propaganda so much as, you know, they're very much of their time, and they're sort of telling women the proper way to behave. But doing, I like to think of it more like their genre tales that are being subtly subverted as well. I mean, you know that they're all being done with a wink, no matter how kind of oppressive the politics might be.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Dan Nadel, writer, editor, and curator. And we're talking about a new collection he has edited with Frank Santoro called Return to Romance, The Strange Love Stories of Ogden Whitney. Let's talk about a couple of the different comics that are in there, because they just kept getting weirder for me as the further I got along in the book. And the very first comic, Return to Romance, one of the first things I noticed is that Stan Franklin's wife, Astrid Franklin, before the makeover, she sort of looked like Herbie.
Yes, I know. It's weird.
It's totally weird.
Well, that's just sort of one of, that's the Ogden Whitney kind of, the beauty and the horror of it is that he's recycling the same figures.
She goes from Herbie to Betty Page.
Yeah, basically. I know. Strange.
Talk about the story. The story is like classic.
Well, I don't have it in front of me to be perfectly
well,
honest.
This guy, Stan Franklin, has got like a dowdy wife who sort of waits on him, but she's let herself go.
Right. So he's looking for somebody.
And that's she's in the Herbie phase of her looks.
Yeah.
She's got short hair, which means she's dangerous. And then, you know, he starts obviously two-timing her with other women. And then she goes in for the big makeover. And her great quote in the book was, "I owed it to him to be a wife." And
yeah. I know.
And all that means, which apparently means, is like developing your bus line, losing weight, and getting a good hairdo.
Yeah. And that's the kind of thing where I just feel like they're really making fun of that idea.
I have to believe, you know, it's so over the top.
I think so.
I have to believe that. But even some of the titles of these comics, like The Red-Haired Boy and The Pug-Nosed Girl.
I know, they're amazing titles. Well, I will say, Richard Hughes, who did write a bunch of them, always had a great flair for titles, whether it was sci-fi or superheroes or anything. He just had sort of a wonderful sense of wordplay.
And then some of them sort of start to veer into some kind of weird B&D S&M sensibility.
Yeah, there's some of that. Yeah. And
I Want a Real Man really starts crossing a weird sensibility line there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's part of the appeal of these things. They teeter right on the edge of appropriate and inappropriate.
And it's all about, there's a lot about how he views manhood.
Yes, yes. Well, he's clearly conflicted about the proper role for a man, a macho man or a controlling man, and then, of course, the wimpy man. So, yeah, that runs through quite a lot of his work.
It's found again in Courage and Kisses.
Yeah.
And what's weird is there's a woman in there, and I forget her name. But, you know, she shows her how powerful she is. And the details in the comics are very weird. She's hunting mountain sheep in the Andes of Bolivia, as he describes it.
Yeah. Of course.
She's shooting a bear at one point, shooting the rapids in a canoe and on a bucking bronco. And, of course, the guy is afraid of a caterpillar. They have a great scene where there's a caterpillar.
Yeah, the close-up on the caterpillar and his abject terror. No, that's why I think that there's sort of a real tongue-in-cheek aspect to these stories. And even as they're sort of working through these strange moments, there's humor in there. And that's probably what's made them endure.
But it also veers into the surreal. In that same comic,
There's
a ledge on a mountain that is one of the most insane-looking ledges I've ever seen. It's like a wall, a thin wall that she gets stuck on, and he has to go out and run across this narrow thing in order to rescue her. It looks like something out of a dream.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing, actually. It's like vertigo or something.
It is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think that he's drawing on similar pop culture tropes that, you know, people like Hitchcock would use as well.
I think my favorite moment in the entire comic, in The Hard-Hearted Hannah, which is obviously taken from a song,
yeah.
He's out in the country with this woman who's a very tough woman.
Yeah.
And they come across a porcupine, and she just wants to beat it to death. And he goes, no, let the porcupine go. I mean, people who are listening to me describe this right now probably have no idea what I'm talking about. It sounds totally insane, but that's one of the scenes in the comic. I love that.
Yeah, and the reason it works is because Ogden Whitney is drawing it with a completely straight-faced look. So it functions so well because there's no hint at the absurdity of it in the drawing of it.
No, it's a completely straight face.
Yeah.
Now, there's a whole interesting story about how this collection came about. Talk to me about you and Frank Santoro. How did you meet and who Frank Santoro is?
Frank Santoro is a cartoonist, and he did a comic called Storyville back in the mid-1990s.
Oh, yeah.
That meant a lot to me, and he did it under the pseudonym Sirk. So, S-I-R-K, like Douglas Sirk, the romance movie director. And I always loved it, and sort of just always wondered who this guy was. And then I moved to New York in 1999, and a few years after that, I was publishing an anthology, and Frank wrote to me and said, you know, I'm Frank Santoro, I did Storyville, and it just kind of blew my mind because I'd always wondered whatever happened to him. And then we got to be really good friends. He lived in New York as well. And one of the things we did together was look at old, odd comics. So we really both shared this fascination with Ogden Whitney, and that propelled things along.
Well, you describe in the book that you guys would go out to different places and see what you could collect.
Yeah. Well, it was always really fun going to comic book conventions or old comic book stores, old bookstores, and just see the strange comics that we could still lay our hands on. And this is still like early 2000s. I mean, there was obviously eBay was big by then, but there was still enough things floating around in basements and elsewhere that we could find some really interesting things and compare notes about them. And then gradually, Frank's friend Bill Boyschel, who runs a great comic book store in Pittsburgh called Hypothetic Comics, also, it turns out, had quite a big collection of Ogden Whitney comics. He had nursed the fascination with Whitney for many years. So, you know, between the three of us, we kind of cooked up a really good collection of this work, and Frank and I put together the book.
Now, you have an entire book that you published a lot earlier in 2006 called Art Out of Time, and I want to do a separate interview about that, but talk to me about that book, because Ogden was one of the artists you considered in that book.
Yes. Well, Art Out of Time was an attempt back then, going back 15 years, an attempt to really kind of show that there could be an alternative canon, or at least an additive canon of comics, because I was sort of feeling like this idea that is now so dominant, I was probably overreacting in some ways, but this idea that comics had to be serious literature was obscuring all the great comics that were not serious literature, that were doing something else, that were working in different genres or working in a sort of surrealist vein or absurdist.
Let me just stop you for a minute there, because I think you hit on something, because I'm amazed how sort of fossilized the whole idea of the history of comics became pretty quickly.
Yes, it did. Well, you know, I mean, this is a long story, but I think that basically it took so long for comics to get any kind of legitimacy, you know, to even have something as amazing as Mouse get taken seriously, that once that happened, it was hard for people then to go back and want to show that, oh, yeah, there's also all this crazy, unhinged work. So I can understand why the history became kind of a little ossified, and then people felt like they had to defend their turf. But by the same token, it is a really rich and varied medium.
It really is. But it seems like the artists who were lionized and written about the most were the ones who followed a classic artistic tradition. So that artists like Ogden Whitney, who are doing things differently, get no play whatsoever. But they from a public point of view, those comics were read by an awful lot of and enjoyed by an awful lot of people.
That's right. I mean, and as were a lot of the things that were lionized. I think it's just that it's harder to accept things that are not, sort of following in the kind of canonized footsteps.
Is there enough Ogden Whitney romance comics to put out a volume two?
I don't think so. I think this is. I mean, there are, but not of this quality. We did look at what we think is a complete collection. So this is really the best. I think a volume two would sort of be watered down.
Are you going to try do a series from little known comic artists like this?
No, you know, I've done a lot of single artist books, monographs. No, this just had a special place in my heart and in Frank's, and not at the moment. No, I've got some other things I'm working on instead.
Okay, I would like to read more. My guest tonight has been Dan Nadel, writer, editor, and curator, and we've been talking about his new collection that he's edited with Frank Santoro called Return to Romance, The Strange Love Stories of Ogden Whitney. Dan, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to WISN 9.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.